If you will now give your attention to our brother Naglieri as he lectures to us this afternoon or this evening on this most important topic, signs of the times showing Christ's near approach. Brother Ben.
Respected guests, young people, and brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. We begin our considerations this afternoon in Qumran, on the shores of the Dead Sea in Israel. And as you can see in the photo, although it's apparently barren and desolate, this is the location of one of the greatest biblical archaeological finds of the recent past. And that, of course, is the discovery of the scrolls of Qumran, which came to be known as the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, they were discovered quite by accident. There wasn't an archaeological expedition or, a search for archaeological artifacts, but instead these scrolls, which were in the various caves at Qumran in Israel, were discovered by the Bedouin quite by accident were found taken, bought, and different things by those in the different research communities and things like that. And what's quite interesting about the Dead Sea Scrolls is that while there are a few complete scrolls, in general, what they found were fragments of scrolls written around the time of Christ. So just about, 100, 200 years before Christ to 100 to 200 years, say, after the time of Christ. And while the scrolls contain a number of different writings, of course, those of the greatest interest to us are the scrolls containing the scriptures. They contain almost every book of the Bible with just few exceptions. So is the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which was in the 1940s, is that a sign of the times? Not exactly. But the discovery of these scrolls, what it does for us is further confirm the authenticity of the scriptures. Because when the scholars examined these 2,000-year-old documents, what they found was that they were consistent with other texts, such as the Masoretic and the Greek Septuagint. And looking at these various documents determined that things really haven't changed. Now, what you see on the screen is the Isaiah scroll, the Great Isaiah scroll, as it's called sometimes, and it's notable in that it covers the entire book of Isaiah, from chapter 1 in our King James Bible to chapter 66. Over 20 copies of Isaiah's writings were found in Qumran, which is somewhat indicative of the importance of prophecy. As we know, Isaiah was a prophet. And it was, in some cases they only found certain books of the Bible, they only found maybe one fragment of the scroll, whereas with Isaiah they found many, many copies of different portions of Isaiah. And so as we mentioned, the Great Isaiah scroll was preserved in its entirety, and it's on display, or a facsimile of it is on display in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Now, as we mentioned, Isaiah, of course, is a prophet. And so while the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls is not really a sign of the times, the things contained in the prophecies of Isaiah are and can be used by us to discuss the signs of the times. So let's just start first with Isaiah 44 and 45. And what's interesting, you'll see on the left side of the screen there, what they've done with the different Dead Sea Scrolls. They've, digitized them. They've scanned them in. You can go online. You can actually take your computer mouse and hover over the different parts of the scroll. And even if you can't read Hebrew, which I certainly cannot, and I'm sure many others cannot, you are able to identify which part of Isaiah you're reading. So if we look at Isaiah 44, and 45. We'll start in chapter 44. Let's look at the prophecy that's contained therein. Sing, O ye heavens, for the Lord hath done it. Shout, ye lower parts of the earth. Break forth into singing, ye mountains, O forest and every tree therein. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob and glorified himself in Israel. skipping down a little bit there. The Lord saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah ye shall be built. That saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple thy foundation shall be laid. Now let's just stop there for just one moment before we can continue into chapter 45 of Isaiah. Consider the things that Isaiah is prophesying here. He says, Jerusalem shall be inhabited, and the cities of Judah shall be built. The only thing is that at the time that Isaiah was recording this, Jerusalem was inhabited, and the cities of Judah did not need rebuilding. So what is he speaking of? Of course, he's speaking of a future time. And the hint we have, of course, is in the name of Cyrus. Let's continue into chapter 45, just read a couple of sections here. Thus saith the Lord to his anointed, to Cyrus, whose right hand I have holden to subdue nations before him. For Jacob my servant's sake and Israel mine elect, I have even called thee by name, speaking of Cyrus. I have surnamed thee, though thou hast not known me. I am the Lord, there is none else, there is no God beside me. I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that they may know from the rising of the sun and from the west that there is none beside me. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Some interesting and remarkable prophecies by Isaiah. If we look at a timeline of the kings and prophets of Israel and Judah, what we have here on the screen, we have basically in yellow there, those are the kings of Israel. In green, we have the kings of Judah. And if we look for Isaiah on the far right side of the screen, you'll see that he prophesied from roughly 750 BC to roughly 690 BC or so. So Isaiah was prophesying during the time of several kings, but preeminently he was prophesying during the time of King Hezekiah, and of course, as we mentioned, as others as well. So the latest prophecies of Isaiah would have been from around 690 BC or thereabouts. Now let's fill in the rest of the picture of the timeline. If we look below, we see the green coming to an end. At the bottom of the screen, we see Zedekiah as the last king of Judah. You can see in bold text there, the temple destroyed, 70 years captivity. And Cyrus, whom we've just read of in Isaiah 44 and 45, doesn't come on the scene until 550 BC. Now, what does this mean? This means that from the time of Isaiah to the time of Cyrus, there was a minimum of 100 years, perhaps more, maybe as many as 140 or 150 years even, between the time when Isaiah was prophesying of Cyrus and the time when this individual came upon the scene. And what we see of Cyrus is validated even in profane history. This here is just a snippet from Britannica online, formerly, of course, the Encyclopedia Britannica. And you can see there Cyrus the Great, born 590-580 BC in Media or Persis, now in Iran. He died around 529, et cetera, and you can read more about him. Other than the Old Testament scriptures, the best source of information about Cyrus is the Greek historian Herodotus. And as we mentioned, he lived during these years mentioned, 590 to about 529. So Cyrus' existence was real, of course. We don't doubt that in the slightest. But what does all this have to do with the signs of the times? Well, let's look in Webster's Dictionary, and let's look at a few definitions. If we look at the term signs in Webster's Dictionary, we see something indicating the presence or existence of something else. If we look up times, we have a historical period, conditions at present or at some specified period. And for signs of the times, Webster's has something that shows the kinds of things that are happening, popular, important, etc., in a culture at a particular period in history. And by way of example, Webster's has having metal detectors in schools is a sign of the times. So I think that that's all pretty self-evident, you know, the meanings of those things. The question is, what does it mean with reference to the Bible? With reference to Bible things, we would suggest to you that the signs are the fulfillment of prophecies. And the times refer to a particular era or age. Therefore, the signs of the times with which we are interested are the fulfillment of Bible prophecies indicating the nearness of a particular era or a particular age. So, if we return to the year 540 BC or thereabouts, and if we imagine ourselves as an individual living during these times, and in particular, we'll say a faithful individual, perhaps a faithful Jew, who was acquainted with the prophecies of Isaiah from over 100 years before, if we saw the sign of Cyrus, in other words, the arrival of Cyrus appearing on the political scene, conquering Babylon, if we dutifully read the prophecies of Isaiah, or in these cases the scrolls communicated to the Jews of after years, we would know that the times when Jerusalem would be re-inhabited and be rebuilt was nigh at hand. Because Cyrus fulfilled the prophecies of Isaiah 44 and 45, as history has come to show. So this is an Old Testament example. Let's quickly look at a New Testament example. We had for our reading just beforehand, Brother Tim read the excerpt from Luke 21, which began at verse 25. Let's back up just a couple of verses to verse 20. This is Christ speaking. He says, "When ye shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh. Then let them which are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let them which are in the midst of it depart out. And let not them that are in the countries enter therein too. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled." This a prophecy of the Lord Jesus Christ, indicating those things which would come not terribly long after he would depart the scene. And if we look at profane history, we find that it was so. We read from Josephus in his Wars of the Jews, Book 6, about the Romans taking over Jerusalem. Josephus records, "When the Romans went in numbers into the lanes of Jerusalem with their swords drawn, they slew those whom they overtook without mercy, and set fire to the houses whither the Jews were fled, and burnt every soul in them, and laid waste a great many of the rest. Titus entirely demolished the rest of the city and overthrew its walls. As for the rest of the multitude that were above 17 years old, he put them into bonds and sent them to the Egyptian mines." Just as Christ had said. So if we think about this time period, if we were one of the Jews living at the time of Christ, or just after the time of Christ, there were some faithful Jews who heard what Christ said and heeded his warnings. And when they saw these signs of the times, they fled. But those who did not, the majority, were subject to the siege, famine, captivity, and death. So why should we spend time on these events of the past, Cyrus and Jerusalem and things over 2,000 years ago nearly? The reason, of course, is because believers of the Bible, true believers of the Bible, in all past ages have been able to follow the Bible prophecies to understand their times and to see the signs of their times. So the question is, what times are we waiting for? What age or era should we be watching for today? And of course, we are waiting for the return of Christ to the earth, to reestablish the kingdom of God on earth, to reign as king, and to set up his kingdom to rule for 1,000 years in peace, prosperity, and in righteousness. So let's go back to the prophet Isaiah, where we've already spent a little bit of time, and look at just a couple of the prophecies related to these times that we are anticipating. If we look in Isaiah chapter 2, it says, "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and all nations shall flow unto it. Out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. We read in Isaiah chapter 9, very familiar, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given," etc. He says, "Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever." And one more. In Isaiah chapter 11, we read, "The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, the leopard shall lie down with the kid," etc. We read, "They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." These are the times that we wait for so earnestly. So if we take the simplest version of a historical timeline, there are really three key points or key events, if you will, that stand out to us. First, we have the creation. And when we say the creation, we're not talking about the creation of the planet and the universe as such, but the creation of our dispensation, the creation of man, recorded beginning in Genesis 1, verse 2, the creation of Adam and Eve and animals and all things living. Next, notably, we have the birth of Christ as the promised seed, around which, we might add, all of the world's history turns, despite the efforts of some to rename B.C. before Christ into B.C.E. before Common Era. Nonetheless, it still is dated around the birth of Christ. And the third event, we would say, that stands out to us, of course, is the beginning of the Kingdom Age, the millennial reign, the 1,000 years. But you might ask, how do we know that God has a 7,000-year plan, as we've set out here? Indeed, if we're going to watch for the signs of the times, then it is vitally important that we understand the times first and foremost. So how do we know? We would suggest to you that it is in the parable of the creation. We spoke just a minute ago about the creation a little bit. And if we read in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, which we don't have time to do now, but if we were to read in Genesis 1 and 2, we would see that the creation work was done in 7 literal days. And Genesis chapter 1 is actually quite specific about it. It leaves really no room for doubt. The creation was done day by day. It says the evening and the morning were the first day, the second day, the third day, etc. And specifically of the seventh day in Genesis 2, it says, "On the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made. And he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made." The key then is this parable of the creation. We see 7 literal days indicating to us a 7,000-year plan, because the beginning of the millennial reign, which we are looking for, will be the rest. It aligns to that rest that God took on the seventh day after seeing all that was created, and he saw all things and he said it was very good. And this 1,000-year period at the end of the timeline here corresponds to it. So the question is for us then, how can we discern where we are on the timeline? Now, you can see in red there, we've put the year 2021 as we are currently in, as it's denominated today, and you can see that we've put that, you know, very close to the beginning of the millennial reign. So the question is, how do we know that this is the case? There are 2 key areas of prophecy that we need to look at, which help us to be sure that we know that we are in these particular times. If we turn to the book of Daniel, there are many prophecies in the book of Daniel, but we'll focus just on one particularly, which is found in Daniel chapter 2. And it's the prophecy related to the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream. We read from Daniel chapter 2, Daniel speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar. He says, "Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold. his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was Daniel telling to Nebuchadnezzar the dream that he had seen. And once Daniel had validated that he knew the dream, because remember, Nebuchadnezzar did not divulge the details of the dream to the magicians and the astrologers or to Daniel. He knew that when somebody could tell him what the dream was, they too would be able to interpret it. And so Daniel did, with the help of God. Daniel says, "Thou, Nebuchadnezzar, art this head of gold. After thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, and the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. But it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. The great God hath made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall come to pass hereafter." We see in the image on the right-hand side of the slide the kingdoms represented by the different parts of Nebuchadnezzar's image. We have, of course, the head of gold, which represented Nebuchadnezzar himself, the Babylonian Empire. The breast and arms of silver, representative of Cyrus and the Medes and Persians. The belly and thighs of brass, the Macedonian or the Greeks. The legs of iron, the Romans. And then the feet and toes, part of iron, part of clay, those that came after the Romans. And in particular, we see in Daniel chapter 2, where Daniel prophesies to Nebuchadnezzar and says, "It is in the days of these kings," referring to the time period of the feet and toes, "that the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed." This, then, in the book of Daniel, is not just a prophecy, but it is really the prophecy by which we can understand the times. Because if we look back in history, and we look over the past several thousand years, we see the Babylonian Empire has come and gone. The Medes and Persians, likewise, the Greeks, even the Romans. And that leaves but the last part of the image yet remaining. Now, the second area of prophecy that we would be remiss if we didn't look at with respect to the times is the book of Revelation. And we certainly do not have time to do neither the book of Daniel nor the book of Revelation justice. We could spend many hours speaking on both of these topics. But the book of Revelation is more or less an extension of the prophecies of the book of Daniel. And we see declared in the opening verses of the book of Revelation, the preamble, if you will, this in verses 1 through 3. "The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him, to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. And he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John, who bear record of the word of God, and of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and of all things that he saw. Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written, for the time is at hand." Now again, as we mentioned, there are many, many aspects to the book of Revelation, so much so that we know that there have been volumes of books written on the subject. But what we wish to point out with reference to our address this afternoon is that it speaks for itself in the opening verses that it is speaking to the servants of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the true believers, speaking of those things which would come thereafter. And we know that John recorded the book of Revelation, sometimes called the Apocalypse, around the year 95-96 AD. So from that point and forward, it would be a guide to the servants of the Lord Jesus Christ to understand how the time is at hand, as we read in these verses here. So if we look just very, very briefly and at a very high level, some of the symbols of the book of Revelation, because as we saw, and I should have pointed out on the previous slide, in verse 1 there where he says, he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John. That means that he signed it or he showed it by symbol. The book of Revelation is a book of symbols. We see four interesting symbols in the book of Revelation, in addition to many more. In chapter 5, we have seven seals. In chapter 8, we become acquainted with seven trumpets. In chapter 15, there are seven golden vials. And in chapter 10, seven thunders. Now, we do not have the time to speak particularly of any of these, but what we wish to share with you is this diagram, which generally conveys the scheme of the book of Revelation, or the apocalyptic scheme. And what we want to show is how the seven seals contain the seven trumpets, the seventh trumpet contains the seven vials, and the seventh vial, contains the seven thunders. It's like a telescope, as it were. And each of these symbols corresponds to a different period of time, judgments upon different areas to individuals over the course of the past 2,000 years. So during the seal period, the seventh seal period, it runs up to the time of Constantine, symbolic of judgments on paganism. The seven trumpet period, after Constantine comes onto the scene, judgments on so-called Christian Rome. Then we come to the time of the French Revolution, from which commences the seven vial period. And during this time, we have further judgments until we come to where we believe we are today in the sixth vial period, awaiting the seventh vial period, which will bring not only Armageddon, but also judgments upon Catholic Europe. So we wish to show this, again, not because we can get into the details of these things, but to show that the book of Revelation, as a book of symbol, shows a continuous historic unfolding of prophecies over the past 2,000 years, from the time of the Apostle John in just about 100 AD up until the present day. And we know that it is so because the book of Revelation is, by this, somewhat of a measuring stick or a timeline by which the true believers of the past 1,900 years have been able to discern their nearness to the return of Christ, by heeding the signs of the times, by understanding the symbols and the prophecies contained therein. And so then we're quite comfortable showing that in the year 2021, we are very near the beginning of the millennial reign of Christ as we come to understand the different times through the different prophecies. What then are some of the signs of the times? After all, that's our subject, really, that we've been asked to speak upon. What are the signs of some of these times that we said that we're looking for? Looking for the return of Christ, looking for the establishment of Israel, looking for all these things to come to pass of which we've just spoke. What events today are fulfilling the prophecies, signaling to us that the time of Christ's return is rapidly approaching? Well, we'll start with David Ben-Gurion, standing below the portrait of Theodore Herzl. Of course, Herzl was the founder of the modern-day Zionist movement. And although he did not live to see this event, we have here David Ben-Gurion reading the Declaration of the State of Israel in May 1948, as was alluded to by Brother Jason yesterday. The reestablishment of a nation, the reestablishment of a homeland for the Jews. We see the Palestine Post for May 1948. The State of Israel is born, just as the British mandate expired. And immediately, it came under attack. And I just want to read, I know the text is probably pretty small, but I just want to read right underneath the headline there where it says State of Israel is born. Just read part of this. It says, the first independent Jewish state in 19 centuries in 19 centuries, was born in Tel Aviv as the British mandate over Palestine came to an end at midnight on Friday, and it was immediately subjected to the test of fire. As the state of Israel was proclaimed, the battle for Jerusalem raged, with most of the city falling to the Jews. All at the same time, or rather at the same time, President Truman announced that the United States would accord recognition to the new state. And here we have the document signed by U.S. President Harry Truman in May 1948, indicating that the U.S. government had been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel, approved by President Truman. What's so notable about this? Well, if we go back to our timeline and we put in AD 70, which we've spoken of a few minutes ago, the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, and then in 1948, the establishment of the State of Israel, we find ourselves with a period of nearly 1,800 or more than 1,800 years wherein there was no Jewish state. And that is remarkable that in 1948, just less than 100 years ago, people, of course, still living, who were alive at that time to witness such an event, that state, the state of Israel, was reestablished. Because if we think about some of those empires and peoples, even if we just look at what we considered in Daniel chapter 2, what happened to the Babylonians? They're gone. The Medes and Persians, gone. The Greeks, the Romans, those empires no longer exist. Pardon me. In many cases, different people of whom we read, whether in the Bible or just in profane history, they disappear altogether. But not the Jew. Not the people of Israel. Not God's chosen people. Although for a time scattered and still scattered today, there is still a diaspora of Jews today. After 1,800 years from the time of the destruction of Jerusalem until 1948, the Jews were able to again in their land. And we'll come back to this point shortly, Lord willing. Let's look at another sign of the times. If we consider the prophecy of Daniel 12, we read, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Now, if we're familiar with the prophecy of Daniel, we know that chapter 12 is the last chapter of Daniel. And it's interesting here what he is told, that many shall run to and fro, knowledge shall be increased. And there may be more than one way that we can understand these phrases, but if we take them somewhat literally, if we think about the way that people move around the world today is quite dramatically different than even 200, 300, 400, 500 years ago. What you have on the screen in front of you is international tourism, right? So this is not necessarily anything related to business or trade or necessity of movement, right, for any particular purpose. This is just for leisure, for tourism. And you see amounts to the tune of $1.4 trillion U.S. dollars spent in international tourism in 2019. And, of course, you see the sharp dip in 2020 due to the worldwide outbreak of the coronavirus. But nonetheless, year over year, more and more individuals on the move, as they have been now for some time. We think about knowledge being increased. One way we can look at that is the global literacy rate. Just over the past 40, 50 years or so, the global literacy rate, as it's estimated, has continued to increase, converging almost up to about 90% of people ages 15 years and older. Whereas in many former years, many individuals were illiterate and unable to read, unable to write. And we could go on for a long time talking about how knowledge has been increased. Just the fact of us being able to have this presentation in this format, to be able to speak and to hear one another over the internet in this way is by far a significant sign of knowledge being increased in the last days. Let's look at some news articles. Most of these are fairly recent. This one from September 2nd, the Associated Press. The European Union pushes for more autonomy amid Afghanistan fallout. Now, over the past couple of months, the debacle in the eyes of many with respect to how the withdrawal from Afghanistan was handled has had some interesting impact around the world. Of course, a lot of the attention has been focused on the United States, the Biden administration, and things like that. But here we have an article by the AP discussing the implications to Europe. Notice what he says here, or notice what the article says. Still reeling from the European Union's shortcomings in Afghanistan, officials from the 27-nation bloc on Thursday discussed ways to improve their response to future crises and not be so reliant on the United States. Continuing down there, we have this top diplomat, the EU top diplomat, saying the only way forward is to combine our forces, that is EU forces, and to strengthen not only our capacity, but also our will to act. Without American support, the European countries wouldn't have been able to guarantee the safe exit of their citizens or even their troops. And so the result, we see this chairman of the military committee of the European Union saying the strategic situation, the geostrategic changes show that we need a stronger Europe. The situation in Afghanistan, Libya, Middle East, Sahel show that now it's the time to act, starting with the creation of a rapid European entry force able to show the will of the European Union to act as a global strategic partner, as they call it. So we see a shift away from reliance, or a desire anyways, on the part of some to no longer be so reliant on the United States after they saw what they determined to be a real terrible handling of the Afghanistan withdrawal in many respects, and realizing that they themselves were very dependent upon the United States. The European Union, although not explicitly mentioned here in the extract, looking to form basically an army, as has been discussed amongst some for some time. This from October 5th in the Washington Post. Blinken meets Macron as countries seek to repair relations following clash over submarine deal. Now, Blinken is the United States Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. Macron is the President of France. And you may have seen in the news here just recently over a, in the eyes of the French, a very poorly handled situation between the French, the Australians, Britain, and the United States about a deal for submarines. We'll read a little bit here. It says, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken held last-minute talks with French President Emmanuel Macron in Paris on Tuesday, suggesting that the two countries are seeking to repair relations following an angry feud over a U.S. submarine deal with Australia. Basically, just to kind of summarize a little bit here, the French had a deal lined up, with Australia, to provide them at considerable cost with certain submarines and other military equipment and things, I'm sure to the tunes of billions of dollars, and the United States basically positioned themselves in a way to make a deal with the Australians and also, I believe, with the UK, and basically causing Australia to drop this deal with the French, which made the French quite angry. If we read the second to last paragraph there, it says, but beyond French officials' lingering resentment over this incident, the Anglophone Pact, okay, that means the agreement between the English-speaking nations, has added urgency to debates in some European capitals over the future of the continent's security and its decades-long reliance on the United States' far greater military reach. Macron says, Europeans need to stop being naive and assert independence from the United States. Do we see a theme here? We see, again, the desire of many in Europe, or some at least in Europe, to turn away from relying or, you know, and to certain extents, leaning on the United States. And we also want to, you know, call attention again to what alignment was made here. This just being one deal, of course, but it was a significant military deal between the English-speaking nations. We heard Brother Jason again yesterday refer to the Tarsus, the Young Lions, the associated countries, the English, primarily English-speaking, nations. Now, at the same time that we have some European countries in these sorts of feelings about, you know, setting up a military force, becoming less reliant on the U.S., although really there's not a harmony amongst the 27 countries on this point, there are still some areas in the European Union that are not interested in setting up a standing army or a standing military force or anything of that nature. At the same time, the European Union, just from a couple of days ago, this article from Reuters, Polish judicial ruling, challenging the EU law, plunges the Union into crisis. It says a Polish court ruling challenging the supremacy of EU law plunged the European Union into an existential crisis on Friday and raised the possibility of Poland leaving the 27-nation bloc. Some have begun to call this Polexit, after Brexit. British exit, although politicians in Poland, some have gone to some length to try to basically say that, no, they're not interested in leaving the European Union. But the root of this particular article here, or the root of this issue, rather, is essentially those in Poland, this ruling, judicial finding, that certain Polish laws are supreme over certain European laws. And we see in the last paragraph here, the primacy of European law is essential for the integration of Europe and living together in Europe. If this principle is broken, Europe as we know it, as it has been built with the Rome treaties, will cease to exist. This Minister for Foreign Affairs from the EU. So just at the same time that we have different things happening within the European Union with respect to the military, we also have an internal crisis of sorts, because if countries begin to throw off the supremacy of EU law, what will be left to hold them together? And so there's quite a bit of turmoil that's been stirred up from this area. So these are some of the things occurring with respect to the European Union. Now, before we go any further, we'd like to look at two prophecies that are relevant to our considerations. We have, first, the prophecy of Daniel chapter 11. We'll read from verses 40 to 42. We read, "At the time of the end shall the king of the south contend with him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships. He shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass through. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall be delivered out of his hand, Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries in the land of Egypt, shall not escape." What do we notice here? We notice a reference to the time of the end, and particularly the king of the north, spoken of as overflowing and passing through. And when we read overflowing, we get the idea of completely overtaking. Now, if we turn to the second prophecy, which I just mentioned, which is the prophecy of Ezekiel 38, we'll be able to make a connection to that of Daniel chapter 11. In Ezekiel 38, we read, beginning in verse 1, "The word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, I am against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal." Now, before we go any further, let's just look quickly at the revised version of these same verses. In the revised version, we have, "Son of man, set thy face toward Gog, of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal." And this is important, Because when we look at the meanings of the names, we find that Rosh, as is correctly rendered here in the Revised Version, the Prince of Rosh, Rosh relates to the word Rosh, which is Russia. And Meshach is Muscovy, the Muscovites. Tubal, this one's pretty evident, relates to the river Tobol, from which the city Tobolsk gets its name. This is pointing to the land of Russia, and in particular, the prince, or the government, or the ruler of this, of the Russian Federation. So we continue in Ezekiel 38, having understood the names, and we'll just kind of go through here quickly. We read, speaking of the king of the north, "Thou shalt ascend and come like a storm. Thou shalt be like a cloud to cover the land, thou and all thy bands, and many people with thee. Thou shalt think an evil thought, and thou shalt say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates, to take a spoil and to take a prey. Sheba, Dedan, and the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions thereof, shall say unto thee," that is to the king of the north, "Art thou come to take a spoil? And thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts." Now, I've mentioned the word north a couple of times, but here we have in the scriptures themselves of Ezekiel 38 saying that they will come from the north parts. Very similar to what we just read in Daniel. We read, "Thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, I will bring thee against my land." So we have here in Ezekiel 38 the identification, the same identification that we saw in Daniel chapter 11, coming out of the north, the king of the north. And notice here that they will come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land. And so we see why it is so important or so significant, the reestablishment of the state of Israel in the light of these prophecies. If at the time of the end, as we read in Daniel, these things are to come to pass, the people of Israel have to be in some form reestablished in their land in order for the Gogian host of the north to come down as a cloud to cover it. So what are some of the things happening with Russia these days? This from September 29th, the New York Times. "Amid tensions with the U.S., Erdogan praises ties with Russia." We have here, of course, you don't need me to tell you that that's Vladimir Putin on the left, and we have the president of Turkey, Erdogan, on the right. "Relations between President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the Biden administration may be frayed." So note that Turkey and the U.S. Having somewhat frayed relations at this time. "But on Wednesday, the Turkish leader made abundantly clear his access to an alternative partner for trade and military deals, namely President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Mr. Putin and Mr. Erdogan discussed weapons deals, trade, and a nuclear reactor that Russia is building in Turkey. On Wednesday," here at the bottom of the slide, "on Wednesday, the Turkish leader used the meeting with Mr. Putin as a platform for praising the military deals with Russia. The cooperation has gone far enough," he said, with Mr. Putin by his side, "that there is no path back in this sphere." Now, we, again, don't have time to go into the details, but the Gogian host, the Russians and their associates, Russia becomes the king of the north by taking Turkey, by taking in particular Istanbul or Constantinople. And so we note with interest the relations between these two nations, and also, even in the beginning of the article, a side reference to the lack of relations in some respects between Turkey and the U.S., although Turkey is a member of the North American Treaty Organization, or NATO. Also, happenings with respect to Russia, we have here from October 4th from Reuters, "Russia test fires submarine-launched hypersonic Zircon missile for the first time." Now, many of you likely remember in 2018, President Vladimir Putin of Russia put out a rather ostentatious hopefully that's the right word, but a rather remarkable speech, although he has some rather outlandish speeches over the years. But in this particular speech, he had an animation.